This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 63, and I'm your host, Simon Bound. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And every Thursday, I release an episode called Paranormal Stories, and that has UFO cases as well as information on evidence of an afterlife. And if you want to hear the extended version of this interview, which is an extra 30 minutes, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. And this week I'm talking to Grant Cameron about his book, Weird, Paranormal Tales of Apparitions and Manifestations. Grant Cameron has been a UFO researcher since 1975. He's the winner of the Leeds Conference International Researcher of the Year and the UFO Congress Researcher of the Year. He is a world-recognized expert on presidents and UFOs, the Canadian government and UFOs, the alien music connection, and the relationship of consciousness to UFOs. Cameron has lectured widely in Canada, the United States, and Europe. He was one of the 40 witnesses that testified in front of six ex-senators and congressmen in Washington for the Citizens' Hearing on Disclosure. He has appeared on many television documentaries on UFOs and has been interviewed on nearly 100 radio shows, including a series of appearances on Coast to Coast AM. Hi, Grant. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, Simon. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
So we're going to be talking about your book. It's called Weird, Paranormal Tales of Apparitions and Manifestations. So first of all, could you just describe for the listeners, what is an apport?
Well, there's a lot of dispute about an apport. Apport is sort of means to move. So the way we have defined it in the book, and everybody has a different interpretation, mine is that if something is moving around, an object moves from one place to another place, it's been apported, it's been moved. And manifestations is where an object has sort of appeared from nowhere, that people really don't know where it's come from.
How did you become interested in apports? Because they're more kind of to do with mediumship, I thought, than UFOs.
Well, actually, it's like everything else in my UFO career. It happened totally synchronistically. I didn't intend to have it. I was at LAX in Los Angeles going to speak at a conference, and I was with Ray Hernandez, who was one of the founders with Edgar Mitchell of the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial and Extraordinary Experiences. And we were sitting there waiting for an Uber to come to pick us up to take us to the conference. And there was about three different Ubers that missed us. And so we were there for maybe 35, 40 minutes waiting for this Uber. And we were just sort of discussing, UFO research and what's going on and stuff like that. And I asked him at one point, I said, who's your best guy? Of all the experiencers, because I maintain the same as he does, is that if you want to find out what's going on in the UFO phenomena, you have to deal with the people who are interacting with the phenomena, and that is the experiencers. And a lot of people don't really want to take it as evidence because they say, oh, it's anecdotal, even though everything's basically anecdotal. Even you take a look at the Nimitz story. Well, that's two pilots, anecdotal stories of what they saw in the sky. So a lot of stuff is anecdotal. So I said, who's your best guy? And he said, well, this Alberto guy. And he just starts describing this guy. And then he says, and he's got all these apports. He's got this whole collection of stuff. He's got a cabinet and there were swords falling out of the ceiling and stuff like this. And I went, what? What are you talking about? I had never heard this before in my life. And I thought, this is really weird. And so he starts describing how this fellow is a UFO experiencer. And he had all these things starting to appear. And so when that was all over, he told me this story. And I'm thinking about this is kind of weird. And then I was going to another conference right after that. And that's when I started to look this up. I started looking up on Google, like apportations and what does this all mean and how it fits in with ufology. And it was at that point that I came across a guy who was Krippner was his name. He was a famous parapsychologist who had done some research on apports, and he had done it with a psychic out of Brazil. And this psychic could make all this stuff appear and objects and stones and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, wow, this is pretty weird. And then so I was listening to one interview that he had done. And that's when I sort of clued in that I had to do this. And he was talking about the fact that he had all these ports that he had collected, and somebody had broken into his house and stole all these stones and gems and stuff that had fallen out of the ceiling with this psychic. And he said, so I decided that what I would do is I would put them at a university instead of keeping them in my house, and I would keep them there, and then they'd be safe. And he said, so I sent them to a university in Canada, to the University of Manitoba. And I went, oh my goodness, I worked there for like almost four decades. I went to university there, and I was four decades there. And I got like, what's the chances that there's only two apport collections in the world? One is here at the University of Manitoba where I am, and the other is at Stanford University. And that's where Gary Nolan is. And that's where the guy who founded Stanford University, I don't know if it's in the book, but the story was that his son had died. And so they started doing seances. This is back in the late 19th century, and trying to contact the son. And his brother, Stanford's brother, was big into mediumship. And he had gotten involved with a medium in Australia. And it was all the material he had collected had been put at Stanford University. And he had provided huge amounts of money. Like Stanford provided the grant for the original university, which is actually called the Leland Stanford Junior University. It's not Stanford, because it was named after his son who had died. And his son had come to him in a dream and said that he was to carry on for the children of California. That's when he started Stanford. But Stanford's brother was into this mediumship stuff. And he had taken all the stuff that he collected, the apports and manifestations that had appeared during these seances with this guy in Australia, and he'd put them in a collection at Stanford University. And he'd given a huge amount of money to the Stanford University to do parapsychology research. And of course, because science is basically controlled by a bunch of people who don't believe in paranormal stuff, they basically said, well, there's a waste of time using this. So they used it to start the first psychology faculty at Stanford University. All that money went in there. None of it went for paranormal research. So it was this idea that the fact that this synchronicity had occurred. And then what happened was, after that, I went to a conference at Laughlin, Nevada. And it was there that this very bizarre thing happened where my PowerPoint was messed with, and it's hard to explain to people unless you've done a lot of PowerPoint and you know how PowerPoint works. But it was this very bizarre thing, almost like the intelligence, whatever it was saying, you want to see something really magnificent, watch this. And I had was setting up the PowerPoint, and I had it all, and what you do is you go in the day before your presentation and you go to the guy who's running the PowerPoint, and you put it through, and the first thing you do is he says, find an audio. And basically they want to see if the audio is working and the video is working for the conference. And so I was looking for these two audios, and I was flipping through, and it's like they weren't there. And suddenly I realized that some of the slides were doubled, some of them were tripled, some of them were sort of pulled, like there's a 3x4 format and a 9x16 format for widescreen. And it's almost like they'd taken the one format and put it into another, so the image on the PowerPoint was sort of stretched. And then there was one where I was doing a whole deal on orbs being found in photographs of black helicopters, and that one was flipped on its side. And I'm going through this, and I can't find the audio. And the guy says, "Well, maybe you made a mistake." I said, "I've done PowerPoint hundreds of times. I know what I'm doing here." And it was like I'm trying to defend myself that there's no way I would make these kind of mistakes of doubling and tripling slides. And then I left the stage, and I said, I'm going to reload this thing. And it was back in my room and on the computer, and I was on a thumb drive. So I took the thumb drive and I went back and I looked at the presentation on my desktop. It was sitting there, and there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. And so I cleaned the thumb drive completely, nothing on it. And then I reloaded again, went running back up there, and did the same thing, and it did the same thing again. And it was just, I was just floored. And I remember Paula Harris was saying to me, are you still going to come to the dinner at 8 o'clock at the Italian restaurant? And I said, no, Paul, I got problems with my PowerPoint. She said, well, you know what's going on, don't you? And I said, no, it's not what's going on. But in the end, I really did. And I finally said to the guy who was running the PowerPoint, I couldn't find these audios. And then finally we went down. He said, well, just keep going. And all of a sudden the audios were there, but they were on different slides, which is, if you know PowerPoint, absolutely impossible. There's no way you can take an audio, which is embedded on a slide, and move it to another slide. So the audios were on different slides. And I was so floored by this whole thing that I went, wow, this is pretty spectacular. And these experiences just started going. There's a feather story that's in the book that just went on. It involved a lot of people out of Great Britain that were in the United States at the time. There was maybe, I can't remember what it was, 12 people and 15 different incidents with feathers that all occurred within a couple of weeks. It was just the most bizarre thing. And so I decided I was going to do a book, and I actually went to Krippner and I was asking him whether I could use the photographs of some of the reports that he'd gotten from the psychic in South America. And then he said, well, it's about time someone did a book on this. And I think this is one of the only books that's ever been written on this phenomena of apports and manifestations, which is a very bizarre aspect, which happens all over the place. It happens in, you read in the book, there's a lot in physical mediums. There's a lot in psychics, but there's also a lot in, a lot of UFO experiencers will have apport manifestation type stuff. And if you look at the Skinwalker Ranch, I absolutely maintain the reason that the OSAP went to Skinwalker Ranch was not to go and investigate UFOs, because Jacques Vallée said that was one thing we really didn't have there was UFOs. They had a lot of orbs. They had a lot of apports, things mysteriously disappearing, reappearing, moving around, stuff like that. That's what they were trying to do, is the military was to investigate this phenomenon, because it does have a lot of military and intelligence applications. And in the book, I actually described the one document from the Defense Intelligence Agency from 1974. So this is, you know, many, many years ago. And in that document, they say they wanted to perfect this idea of apporting stuff. And they said the military application would be that we could go, say, to the Russians. We could go into the vault. We could take the documents. We could bring them back to America. We could photocopy the documents and put them back in the vault, and the Soviets would never even know that we were there. So this is this whole deal. This is what they're trying to figure out, is how can you make stuff disappear and reappear? Or at Skinwalker Ranch, the most spectacular story at Skinwalker Ranch was definitely the four bulls, where the guy realized that they were messing around with his stuff. And he said, oh, I hope they don't get my bulls. And he goes running out of the house, and he's all excited, and he looks in the corral and the bulls are gone. And he's going, oh, my prize bulls. And then he looks over at this trailer that's sitting there, and the trailer is locked. It's been locked for many years. And he wonders, he says in his mind, I wonder if they put the bulls in the trailer. And he opened up the trailer, undid the lock and opened up the trailer. And the bulls were squashed into this trailer like sardines. And as soon as he opened the door, they started to panic, and they actually broke the trailer. So this is the kind of stuff which is very, very bizarre, but it does happen a lot around UFO experiences.
And you mentioned Stanford University there, and you said in the book that they had experiments there with remote viewing, and weird objects manifested while they were doing it.
Yeah, that was hell put off. Because so when they had the whole dispute about the medals, and you see, I talk about the medals in the book. And I keep saying to people, like, you know, this doesn't make any sense. I said it to Jacques Vallée when I interviewed him. I said, Jacques, this doesn't make any sense. I mean, come on, this UFO comes flying across the, you know, the galaxy, you know, avoiding black holes and stars and planets and stuff. And it gets here, and then little pieces start falling off the craft. I said, come on, this is manifested material or apported material, that they're dropping this stuff on purpose. And when I contacted Hal Puthoff, I said, Hal, I said, you're looking at all this metal, you guys, and you know it's apported material. I mean, you know it's apportation, because you had it in the lab. And so in the 1970s, when they were doing the remote viewing stuff at Stanford Research Institute, they tell the story where Uri Geller is there, and they go for lunch, and they're at the lunch, and Uri Geller is eating ice cream, and he puts some ice cream in his mouth, and he bites down, and he cuts his mouth, and he pulls out this thing out of his mouth, and it's an it's a pin that belonged to Edgar Mitchell, who was actually sitting at the table with Hal Puthoff. And Edgar Mitchell said, "Where did you get that pin? I lost that in Houston 2 years ago." And he handed over the pin to Edgar Mitchell. And this is the idea. It's like an item. It's just for the idea of really weird to make you think and make you wonder, like, what the heck's going on? And so he takes the pin and they're all puzzled by this. And they go back to the research institute. And that afternoon, they're in one room and Uri Geller's in another room. And then they hear this noise of a piece of metal falling. And they look around and the back half of the pin is on the floor for the pin that was in the ice cream. And then they had another piece that had a ported as well. So that's what I said to Hal Puthoff. I said, "Hal, you know, this is a ported material. This is, you know, this is not pieces falling off flying saucers." And Hal, he's always very short the way he responds. He doesn't really, you know, use a lot of words. He just said, we'll investigate the metal one step at a time. So he didn't deny that this was a ported material. And that was the whole deal, is this has been going on for an awful lot of time. And it happens around Uri Geller. In fact, the one story I tell in the book, and because Uri Geller is a very controversial character. And I tell the story about John Lennon in the book, where John Lennon has this sort of abduction type experience, wakes up in the middle of the night. He tries to wake up Yoko Ono. You hear this story with, you know, abductee type stories where their partner's sleeping, they can't wake them up. And he sees some light coming in front of the door in the hallway. And he assumes that the hallway, there's a fire in the hallway, and he's trying to wake up Yoko. "Come on, we got to get out of here." And so he can't wake up Yoko, and he goes to the door and he opens it up and he says these bug people are standing there and they're looking at him. And then he decides he's going to sort of attack them or push them back or whatever. And he said, next thing he realizes, he's lying on his back in the bed and it's the morning time and Yoko Ono's awake. And he tells Yoko Ono about this story about these bug people that were on the other side of this door where the light was coming from. And in his hand, he has this what looks like a bronze egg. And a lot of people say it's a magician's thing that he used or whatever. And so he had this piece, and he met with Uri Geller. He used to have coffee with Uri Geller across the street from the Dakota condos where they live. And he was with Uri, and he said to Uri, he said, "Here, I want to give you something." He said, "This may be my ticket to another planet, but I don't want it. You can have it. I don't want anything to do with it." So he gives it to Uri Geller. And Uri Geller, when I talked to him, said he had kept this his entire career, and it was always on his person. He always moved around with it. He never left it anywhere. And he said, "I never had it investigated because I was always afraid it might be made in Taiwan. He didn't want to, you know, sort of kill the mystery of the whole thing. So he kept this bronze egg." So then, while I'm doing the book, I'm good friends with Sid Goldberg, who's a producer for Gaia TV. He's a Canadian out of Canada, and I knew him fairly well. And so he said to me, he says, "Oh," he says, I'm going to Israel, and I'm interviewing Uri Geller for a 4-part series, and some of it's going to appear in his museum. And is there any questions you want to ask Uri?" And I said, "Well, yeah, of course. Ask him the question about the egg, and get a good photo of it. I don't have a good photo of it, so get a good photo of the egg for me." And so he goes and he asks Uri Geller the question, and Uri tells him basically the same story. And then Sid takes a photo. He's holding the egg in front of him in his hand, and he's sort of pointing it towards the camera for me. And he sends me this photograph, and I see this egg. And I said, "Good photo, Sid. Maybe your ticket to another planet." And I laugh. And so he's at the same time this happens, when he sends me the email and I send the email back to him, he's actually having lunch in Tel Aviv with Uri Geller, and they're sitting at the table. And this is where I say, you can say whatever you want about Uri Geller, but this part of the story, Uri Geller could not have made up. So they're sitting there and they're talking, and Sid Goldberg's talking about me and how the egg and all this kind of stuff. And he says, "Oh, look at this. There's an email from him just as we're speaking." So they're talking, and then Sid Goldberg goes to his email, and that's where I send him the message. With the egg, maybe your ticket to another planet. And he says this to Uri Geller, and then Uri Geller is sort of pointing up, and he says, What do you mean? He says, Listen. And there on the music and in the restaurant was Imagine by John Lennon. So I say, you know, you can make up all the stories you want, but that story, there's no way Yuri Geller made it up because it's told to me by Sid Goldberg. So you see these very bizarre stories. And that's why I get into the whole idea. I have a thing called the theory of wow, that I think a lot of the paranormal, especially the UFO stuff, is all theory of wow. All they want you to do is they want you to go, wow. They want you to realize you don't have this world understood. There's something beyond this world. They want it really weird so you can't get out of the rabbit hole. And you see that happens with people in paranormal phenomena. They just can't let it go. I mean, they end up getting divorced. They you know, read and they study and they, and it's because this weird aspect of it that drags them into it. So that's the whole thing with the apports. That's what I think it is. It's, they're not really doing anything. They're just doing this really, really weird stuff to get your attention, to make you realize that the world is not as physical as we think it is. And it forces you to work on it, work on it, work on it. And as we all work on the problem and we try to figure out what this weirdness is, we start to realize that consciousness is a key part of this. And as the consciousness rises, then eventually everybody will come to accept that, yes, there is this non-physical aspect to the universe.
And I suppose that theory of wow applies to UFOs, isn't it? It's like they're perfectly capable of hiding themselves. So why are they always covered in lights? And why do they move through the sky as a really bright light?
Yeah, that's where I the way I described it, I did one lecture on it one time where I described the grade one class. So it's like people from wherever, you know, wherever they're from, they have their school class and they go to the grade one class and they say, well, you know, we've got these people here and they have an ecological problem and a nuclear problem and stuff like that. And we want to try to get their attention to make them realize that they're part of the whole, they're the part of the one, that they're not separate and they're going to destroy themselves. And so what are we going to do? And the grade one class said, oh, I know what we should do. We should put some UFOs and fly them around with lights on and then they'll get their attention. And then the grade two class decides, oh, we're going to do cattle mutilations to let people know that there's this contaminated areas in the Western United States where you have radioactive fallout from above ground testing. And then the grade three class decides, oh, we're going to do the apports and manifestations. And every class comes up with this new idea of doing these weird things. And it's all the same thing. It all comes back to this idea that it just makes you think that you never do figure it out. I mean, it just gets weirder and weirder as you go along. And as you go up, like now I'm doing the thing with the orbs. And this is, I maintain, is a new type phenomena. And what you can see in the people we have, we actually give it in a thing called the Orbology Institute of Academy of Arts and Sciences, where there's a bunch of people on this group chat group. And there's people like Dr. Bob McGuire, who got involved with this with his partner. He got dragged into this orb thing. We've got these very sharp computer people and they're all working on this stuff. And what you see is the phenomena gets weirder. It gets almost like the crop circle thing. It starts as very simple crop circles and gets more complex and more. And that's what you see happens in this orb phenomena is it's getting more complex. They're doing weirder things and more things. And it's just like, you just like every day, it's like a new world of bizarre stuff that they're doing that it seems to get more complex. And that's, I think, is part of the whole phenomena. But it's just to gain our attention, because if it isn't weird, you're not going to pay any attention to it. I mean, if I hadn't had this bizarre incident where I discovered that one of the only two collections of apportation stuff and manifestation stuff is at a university where I worked for 40 years, I would never have gotten into it. It was just that bizarre aspect of it where I went, wow, this is pretty bizarre. Almost like the story where I did a book on music, where I got dragged into it, where I'm talking to Chris Bledsoe, whose book is just coming out at the end of the month, which is now in four top, you know, four categories, number one book, where he phones me up after I have my experience with him in North Carolina. And he says, oh, I got a message from the beings for you. He called them the guardians. And they want you to know the messages in the music. And I had no interest in music and stuff like that. But it was the bizarre idea that one of the people that he claimed was involved with the music thing was Neil Young, who grew up in Winnipeg where I lived. And it was that thing that dragged me down the rabbit hole and said, wow, I got to look at this. If Neil Young's involved in this thing where the aliens are putting messages in music. And that's the whole thing. It's the synchronicity thing that you probably experienced with other people have experienced, is this weird synchronistic events that happen to you where you just go like, that couldn't be coincidence. That's just so bizarre that it makes you think about it and you can't let it go. And if it isn't bizarre, you just say, it's whatever, and you just let it go. That's why it has to be bizarre. Otherwise, people would not hang on to it.
Can we talk about the things you talk about, metals falling from UFOs? What is it, Bob White? He had an object and it was analyzed by 15 labs.
Yeah, that's the Bob White piece. There's piles of it. Like, people think this is a new phenomenon where these pieces are falling. But this has been going on. In fact, the first major UFO story was not Kenneth Arnold. It was 3 days before Kenneth Arnold was the Maury Island sighting. And at the time, Mary said, it's a garbage, you know. And the Maury Island story was that these two guys were on a boat with a dog, and these UFOs come. And you hear this very similar sort of story where the UFOs are sort of flying along, and then one of the, I think there were six UFOs, I think there was, and then one of them looked like it was in trouble, and it was sort of flipping. And that's the bird, you know, when a bird tries to get you away from the nest, it pretends it's got a broken wing, and then you get distracted by the bird with the broken wing, and then you move away from the nest. And that's the same sort of thing where the UFO is sort of flipping around like it's in trouble, and they're going, whoa, it's gonna crash, and all of a sudden it explodes, and all this metal comes raining down on these guys. And the one guy breaks his arm, the dog gets killed, and that's how the whole UFO thing starts in June of 1947. So this has been going on all the way through, and what it is that people will describe that they're outside, and they have a piece of metal that comes flying out of the sky. The one that we found, we actually found, and a lot of people didn't know about it because they didn't really realize the significance. And the example is, my assistant Destin and I went to James McDonald's collection. It's a massive collection of UFO stuff. He was the major sort of researcher scientist in the 1960s who investigated, you know, he went in front of the UN and all this kind of stuff. And with the hearing, and so we went to James McDonald's collection. We were looking through it, and there's really not that much interesting there. But the one thing we did find at the very end, and we really got a lot of trouble from the archivist for taking stuff out of the boxes and spreading it across the table, which you're not allowed to do, is my assistant found it. She said, look at this piece of metal. And it would look like a spike with a sort of a head on it, which was all bubbly. And this was a report out of 1939 out of Illinois, by a farmer who had seen this thing come out of the sky like a meteorite, and it embedded itself right into his garden. And he went to pick it up, and always the description of the port material is that it's hot, it's warm, or it's even hot, that you can't touch it when it first hits the ground, and then it cools down. So this guy waited, and then he used a knife and he pulled this thing out of the ground, and it looked like this spike, and it was made out of 99% pure nickel. And he had taken, he put it in his garage, didn't know what to do with it. And then in the 1960s, he gave it to his daughter who lived in Tucson, Arizona. And NASA had started a lab there when they were putting man on the moon. And so she took it to the lab, and she said, oh, my father found this. It came out of the sky in 1939. And can you analyze what it is? So they did the analysis, and they determined it was this 99% pure nickel. And there's actually, I produced the letters in the book from the Nickel Company of America, or whatever it's called. And they analyzed, and they said, well, we really can't resolve it. We don't know anything more than you do. We can just tell you that there's nothing in that comes out of the sky at that time that could be that purity of nickel. And they cut off an end to do the analysis of it. And that's when they discovered on the inside of this thing was this copper core. It had a copper core inside this thing. So this piece, I'm not sure where it's gone. It must still be somewhere around in Tucson, Arizona. I don't think it's at the archives, but they just sort of puzzled and didn't know what it was. And it wasn't until we found it, we said, well, this is the same story. This is a manifestation. This is dropping the metal. And you see this over and over again, that people will describe that a UFO is flying along and the UFO explodes, like the one that they were doing with Gary Nolan with the Ubatuba piece out of Brazil, where again, they're on the beach and this UFO explodes and all this metal comes raining down, and Jacques Vallée got a couple of pieces and they analyzed this is where they had this bizarre experience where in the same piece of metal, like the two pieces of metal from the same site, the one has the isotopes are all messed up and the other one, the isotopes are completely normal. And it's the same piece of, it's the same metal fragments. And that again is this port thing. This is this bizarre nature where it's like, well, we'll really make them scratch their heads. Let's mess with the isotopes. And that'll make them, you know, really try to figure out what's going on here. And so they do this bizarre thing where they mess with the isotopes. So to me, it's not that they're building anything out of it, because that's what people make these mistakes. They think, oh, if we get this piece of metal and we figure out how this piece of metal works, we're going to be able to figure out how to build a UFO. And I don't think that's what it's about. It's about doing these bizarre things, like these the piece that Linda Howe sold to the Stars Academy for whatever, it's $35,000 or whatever. And that was this 83 levels of metal with bismuth and magnesium, which don't really bind together, where they put them in these layers together. And then everybody goes like, how do you do that? And it was done like almost at an atomic level. And it's just to get people to go make scratch their heads and try to figure it out. So this metal is appearing all over the place. Even I remember at one time I said it was being extruded from the UFOs. And my friend Chris Bledsoe wrote me back and he said, no, it's not being extruded. It's dripping. And I said, well, how do you know that? And then he tells a story, which is going to be in his book, where this orb is 11 feet up, I think he says, coming down the driveway, and this metal is dripping off this orb. So it flies by, and then he grabs all the, he scrapes this little piece of metal. And in the book, I've actually got photographs of the metal on the driveway, and then he takes it all and they melt it all down. And this was analyzed. So it was sent to whoever and they did analysis of this. So it's these bizarre things, but it's, it always has a bizarre story with it, how the metal appears. And that's what I say. That's what I said to Hal. Hal, this isn't pieces falling off a flying saucer. They're dropping this stuff on purpose. They're trying to get you to be amazed by this, to try to explore it. And it just makes this huge mystery, which forces people to think. And that's what they want, because you can't do your kids' homework for them. You have to make the kid be curious and wonder how this works. And the kid figures it out for himself, and then it'll stick. If they come down, the way we do it is we do almost the Iraq thing. We go into Iraq and we say, we're here to bring you freedom and democracy, Jesus and McDonald's. And then they suddenly the people are pointing guns and saying, get the heck out of here. We don't want to listen to you. They're doing it in this way where they're dragging you along, almost like giving you little breadcrumbs or little puzzle pieces. And we're madly trying to put this thing together. That's how they're revealing the UFO secret or whatever is behind this UFO phenomena and the paranormal phenomena. So it happens all across the spectrum, as you pointed out at the beginning. It happens a lot in physical mediums, and it happens a lot in psychics. And even if you take a look at the story of Michael Talbot, who was an experiencer who wrote the famous book called The Holographic Universe, which he said was downloaded to him. He didn't really write it. It was downloaded to him. And he tells the story of being a kid and having this weird stuff happening, this poltergeist stuff, where he said if he was in a good mood, the poltergeist would hang the socks off the plant in his bedroom. And if he was in a bad mood, he'd wake up with needle marks and pin marks in his arm and blood and stuff like that. And he described the fact that this thing all started by all this gravel ending up on the roof. It was all this gravel was flying, and his father had to go up on the roof and get all this gravel off the roof. So he had this same sort of thing with it follows experiencers. And it's to me, it's just a bizarre type of phenomena, which is very interesting to watch, because you get more and more of these cases. And then you even get cases like the latest one we put in the book, just at the very end, was a seance experience that happened in Illinois. Now, mostly the seance material I got was from Great Britain. But the one that we put at the end of the book was a seance that occurred just before the book was published. And I said to Dest, I said, Dest, you got to stop the print. You got to get this thing. You got to put this story in there. And this was where the same thing, where in a seance where they seal off the room, everything that they could possibly do to make sure there's no fraud and stuff like that. And at the end, 100 pieces of stuff rain out of the ceiling. And I thought, it was almost like they wanted it for the book. It was like, we're going to put this last one in there. It was a friend of mine who I had lectured for last year, had it happen. And that's the thing, is you get these very, very bizarre stories. And I guess the best story that would explain, and maybe they're giving sort of hints as to how the UFO comes in. So the UFO can come in, it can manifest itself in the physical universe, and then it can go back wherever it came from. It can de-manifest. And the story I tell is the Stuart Alexander story out of Great Britain, where Leslie Kane is very involved with Stuart Alexander and was doing the Life After Death project and stuff like that with the documentaries and stuff like that. And she was with Stuart Alexander. And when I got to interview her, all I wanted to ask her was one question. I mean, people want to ask her about the New York Times and, you know, Elizondo and stuff. All I wanted was one question. I said, Leslie, tell me this story about the hand. Did that actually happen? She said, yeah, it actually happened. It happened more than once. And she tells a story how she's sitting at the table and the Stuart Alexander's in this cabinet on the other side of the room. And she's there's this red light under the table, and this sort of watery, misty stuff starts coming up from the bottom of from the side of the table, and it comes above, and then suddenly this hand starts to manifest, And she said, I felt it. And she said, it was as real as any hand I've ever felt. It had, I could feel the knuckles. I could feel the bones. I could feel it. It was warmer than an ordinary hand. It was softer than an ordinary hand. And she felt it. And she said it happened a number of occasions. And then the hand banged a couple times on the table and then just sort of demanifested and went back wherever it came from. So that's what I think is happening with the UFO phenomenon. That may be sort of a hint as to what they're doing. They can manifest in the physical world, do whatever they got to do, and then they disappear. Because they don't really stay very long if you take a look at most of the UFO experiences. I'll talk to people, they'll say, oh, I saw a UFO. And I'll say, so how long was it there? It wasn't there very long. Did you see it? And they go, yeah, I was the only one that saw it. There's a bunch of people, but I think I was the one that saw it. Do you think it wanted you to see it? I kind of think it wanted me to see it. And that's the thing. It sort of manifests and gets somebody's attention, drags them down the rabbit hole, and then disappears. And so it's a very, very bizarre. And I think that's what they want. It's like crop circles. It just gets more bizarre, more bizarre, more bizarre as it goes along. And even when you think you've seen the end of it, then they do something even weirder that just absolutely throws you right off.
And you got a thing about Diana Pasulka, and a NASA engineer told her that the object she had was so anomalous as to be incomprehensible.
Yeah, I'm not sure which piece. I mean, I know there was, they had gone to the gifting field. It was actually a friend of mine that actually, Tyler D was the engineer. And I actually got to meet Tyler D in 2013. That was before he went into secrecy and people weren't supposed to use his name and stuff like that. But when my friend took him to the gifting field, they were at a conference. I think it was at the World UFO Conference in Phoenix. And my friend said to him, he said, we're going on a UFO dig. Do you want to come? And he said, well, yeah, okay, sure. And so they went there and they went on this, what they call the gifting field. And it was in the gifting field where they were pulling up all this material, and they were pulling up metal, ordinary metal plus material. And there was the one honeycomb piece that when Tyler D saw it, my friend said, he said, this is for real. This is for real. And he got all excited. And then he took Diane Pasulka and he took Gary Nolan to the gifting field. And that's when he blindfolded them and took them on there. And that's when she described the fact that there's this sacred part that the engineer and everybody else seemed to know, was that they believe that this stuff is being gifted. So they called it the gifting field. And she said that when they went to the place, as they took off the blindfold, she said she could see that there was altars all over the place, and that this Tyler D built an altar and then they prayed. She was very bizarre, this whole nature. And it was a government site. And then they would go on the site. And she said, there's all these altars all over the place. And that was this idea where this stuff was being gifted to us. And you even have the idea where Bob Bigelow is interviewed. And he's asked by George Knapp, and he said, well, you know, people say there's a crash in Russia. Do you think there's a crash in Russia? And Bob Bigelow said, yeah, there's a crash. There was a crash in Russia, and there was also one in China, and there was one in South America. And he says, they're all over the place. I think they're seeding them. I think this, they're putting this material out to give us the indications, and we were given this stuff. And if you take a look at the Wilson leak document, there's this hint that you've always heard this story, that we were actually given an entire craft, an entire intact craft. And at the end of the Wilson leak document, it says, we have a craft and we think it'll fly, which means to me, clearly, when I saw that, I went, oh, I know what that is. That means they've got an entire craft and they can't turn it on. They can't turn the thing on because you need this consciousness interface. It doesn't work with a key. It doesn't work with an engine. It works with human consciousness. And so we've been given metal, and that's the whole thing, is these stuff that is almost beyond comprehension. Like the piece that was given to TTSA, that was the one where they said that was just mind blowing. How could you get these many levels at that thinness, almost like it was put down atom by atom? Or the one where the isotopes are different. In the same piece of metal, you have or the same crash site, you have two pieces of metal, and one is all messed with the isotopes, which is impossible unless you've got billions of dollars you can invest into trying to change the isotopes in this thing. So Diane saw this, and they were dealing with all this kind of stuff, and they know about this. So they know the metal thing. They're gathering these pieces, and even they have the pieces, and I don't know where they got them from, but Tyler D, the story is told by Chris Bledsoe's son. I don't know if you heard this story, where they had two pieces of metal, and he takes Ryan and he says, Ryan, well, hold out your hand. And he puts the one piece of metal in Ryan's hand and he said, what do you feel? And Ryan says, nothing. And then he takes the second piece of metal and puts it in Ryan's hand and he feels this sort of electricity going up his arm. He, oh, what's that? And he said, oh, that means that you've been face to face with an entity. And he, so he takes the his brothers and his sister, and he does the same experiment with them, and they all get this sort of a shocking sensation going up their arm. And then they do the girlfriend, Chris Bledsoe Jr.'s girlfriend, they do it to her and nothing happens, which would indicate she hadn't been in front. And then they do it to Chris Bledsoe and he basically almost goes into a seizure. He's just totally taken by this sort of stuff. And that's the thing. So when you hear that story where they've got this metal and they know this connection, that if you put these two pieces of metal in a person's hand, you can tell whether they've been directly in contact with an entity, would tend to indicate that they know a little bit more than they're letting on, that they've got some of the stuff figured out. But in terms of other stuff, I think they're totally at loss as to how this thing is working. Almost like Jim Semivan said, not only do we not know how to control, how to connect the dots, we don't even know if there's any dots there. There doesn't seem to be any there, which is this whole idea that when you boil the whole phenomena down, it seems to sort of demanifest into nothing. And you start to wonder, what are we actually dealing with here? That the phenomena is running the show and it's gradually disclosing itself through these bizarre ways. It's not doing left brain stuff. Left brain stuff is going to come down and give you a lecture and tell you what's going on or whatever. It's doing a right brain thing. It's doing symbols. It's doing images. It's doing all this kind of stuff. And they're forcing us to put the pieces of the puzzle together and figure it out for ourselves.
There's a sentence in the book that stood out that says, the artifacts we studied also studied us.
Yeah, that was that came from the whole thing where Whitley Strieber was involved with Tyler D. And that was this idea that Tyler had it in a backpack. He was carrying it around. And they got this indication that the metal was alive and it could interact and it could actually study people. That this was part that it wasn't just simply an inanimate object that was there. It had this bizarre characteristic that part of this whole thing was the phenomena was watching us through the metals and through the stuff that it was dropping. It just gets weirder. This whole story gets weirder and weirder as you go along. And that's what I say to people is that in the end, when you think you've got it all figured out, I come to this idea where the more you look at it, the more it looks like we've got like 100 different puzzle pieces. And it's just, it's way beyond almost like the expression, the universe is not only more magnificent than you think, it's more magnificent than you could ever imagine. It just gets more and more complex the more you look at it.
Well, I wanted to ask you more about physical mediumship, but there was one thing you say in the book that is, if one single event in a physical mediumship circle is valid, our entire paradigm goes down the tubes.
And that's what I think they're trying to do, is they're trying to break down our paradigm of how the world works by doing these things. And the skeptics can always sort of talk their way out of it, or this or that, these elaborate things. But some of the physical seances, some of the stuff that happens is just so bizarre and so unbelievable that if one of those cases, if something manifested and wasn't in the room before, and you can prove it, then you really got to relook at everything about how we think the world works, that things can go through walls or that they can appear out of nowhere. They almost this idea where matter is popping in and out of reality all the time. And so the physical seance is important for that. And the other one I have, I don't think it's in this book, but I talk about it, where you have this idea where channelers and physical mediums will actually change voices and stuff like that. And what that indicates, if you take a look at the famous, her name's going to escape me, famous medium or channeler, Jay-Z Knight, ran this experiment many years ago where when she did Ramtha, was the being that she was dealing. When she did her DNA, when she was normal, she was French, female. But when they took her DNA, when she was channeling Ramtha, where she would actually sort of gain weight, and they did it, and she was Icelandic male. And I've seen a lot of cases where You have physical mediums where they actually will change voices and mannerisms and stuff like that. And you get to the whole idea, is consciousness involved in the DNA and is it physical? And so we're going to run some experiments. We're still going to do it with some physical mediums where we're going to take their DNA when they're normal. And then we're going to take their DNA when they're in trance. And we're going to compare the DNA. And if we can show us, we're looking for the second white crow. If you get a second white crow where suddenly that DNA is different, we've done two people and I didn't think they were channeling at the time, but they turned out to be negative. But there's a bunch of physical mediums who have agreed to do this for us, where they're going to do this test where we can take their DNA while they're channeling. And that changes everything. So if you have a situation where, say, some guy, there's one channeler, Paul Selleck, when he channels, he sort of gets a British accent and his eyes change color. So if your eyes are changing color, that's DNA and something is changing. And so if the DNA changes from one to the other, that's totally impossible. That would indicate that something very strange is going on and that DNA and everything may be this sort of non-conscious element. So a physical mediumship is something you can control fairly well. And there's a lot of people who are very good at it. Stuart Alexander, according to Leslie Kane, is the best she's seen. There's a guy out of Germany who's coming to America. I'm going down to see these guys, and they've agreed to do this DNA test, which absolutely changes everything. If their DNA changes when they're channeling or when they're doing the physical mediumship stuff, then that changes. And if you can confirm that these pieces were not in the room before, but it's pretty hard because the skeptics will always come up with some bizarre explanation to explain, you know, how this material, but physical mediums can make all sorts of stuff. There's even the ones for the whole experiment that was done with in the 1990s. And the name is escaping me. It's a group that was doing physical mediumship in Great Britain, where they had the newspaper.
Was that the skull?
The skull, where they have the newspaper. The newspaper from the 1940s appears and it's like just like a brand new newspaper. And then within a couple of weeks, it turns yellow, and that kind of stuff. That's the bizarre stuff. Where I think if you can get this down, there's more and more people doing experiments. Where especially if you got someone like Leslie Kane, who's actually putting this stuff on national TV in the United States, it raises the consciousness where people think of new experiments that can show either this is happening or it's not happening. But there's a lot of people who are pretty good at physical mediumship, and I've dealt with most of them. There was one out of Great Britain that actually wanted all his stuff pulled out of the book. And it was when you get stuff like that where you go, wow, I mean, maybe, I don't know if this guy's for real, because why would you pull your stuff out of the book? I mean, you're advertising, people are paying to see you do this kind of stuff. And then you have your stuff pulled out of the book that you don't want any of your reports shown in the book. And then you wonder, like, what's going on here? So it's a very important aspect to do it. And Leslie Kane is on this. And she's told some stories that haven't been made public, stuff that's happened, because she could actually log in on her computer from New York. She would go into the closet with her computer and make it totally dark in the closet. And she would enter the seance room, and there was stuff happening in her room where books were falling out of the cabinet. They do this book experiment where the book falls out and you look on a certain page and there's an answer that they already have the answer to, and this kind of stuff. So Leslie was having that. She had this handprint that appeared on the window, all this really bizarre stuff. So she's on the leading edge of this. And I think her experiments and her writing will raise this to a higher level in terms of people wanting to study this. Because if it's bizarre, people always want to be skeptical and they want to say, well, no, I don't really know. But it's not until you challenge this stuff and actually look at it that you can discover either this stuff is true and our idea of the universe is wrong, or it's all phony, which I don't think is going to happen. It's almost like I was actually talking to Gary Nolan just recently, and I asked Gary about this whole thing. And I said, Gary, give me the 5% quote. And basically his 5% quote is, I'm interested. I will tell you about the 95% that I know, but I'm more interested in the 5% that I don't know, because it's the 5% of the anomalies that we don't know that are going to lead you to new discoveries and teach you that something you've got is wrong. So it's the 5% that we don't know that we should be studying, not the stuff that we know. It's the 5%. That's where the Nobel Prizes come from, because every time we discover something new, we discover that something we had was wrong. So that's where we go with this stuff. And that's why the paranormal is so important, because it's the anomalies. If the paranormal phenomena, UFOs, seances, all this kind of stuff, reports, if this stuff was not real, they wouldn't be happening. In the physical world, it says this stuff can't happen. It is happening. There's no doubt this stuff is happening. And that means we've got something wrong, and we got to figure out what it is that we've got. What's the mistake in the equation? And once we figure that out, then we can make inventions. And you see even Tyler Gee and Gary Nolan, they use this process. And Tyler Gee has 40 patents that he claims he's gotten from the beings. Gary Nolan has got this. I said, Gary, I said, tell me the story about, you said, I don't know how it works, but I know how to make it work. And he tells me, and he tells a story, which I'm going to put in an upcoming lecture, where he says, I put it like an FBI thing on the wall in my mind, and I string the things together, put strings between the things that relate or whatever. And I look at all the questions, and I got it in my mind, and then I forget about it. And within a couple of days, the answer comes into my head. And that's what he describes in another case, where he says, I go through all this stuff, and I put the question on the bedside table at night, and then I go to sleep. And within either in the next morning or within the next couple of days, the idea comes in my head. And he's got a lot of patents. He's a multimillionaire. He's got companies and stuff like that. And that's what people don't realize. That's where a lot of these ideas came from. I wrote a book called Inspired, The Paranormal World of Creativity, where I got 13 Nobel Prizes. I look at some of the biggest inventions of all times. And that's where the stuff is coming from. It's coming out of nowhere, where these people realize that there are these anomalies. And if they can tap into this field, all the information is in the field. The experiencers will say, 40% of them say at one point during their experience, they knew the answer to everything in the universe. 31% of people who've had near-death experiences say at one point during their experience, they knew the answer to everything in the universe. And I was actually talking to Nick Cook, who's the Hunt for the Zero Point in Great Britain. I was just talking to him the other day, and he told a story about his wife in 2014, 2015, where she was with her mother. And as her mother dies, she gets up from the bed and she said, everything's good. And he said, what do you mean everything's good? Your mother just died. And she said she was in this field where it was bliss and there was light, and she knew the answer to everything, and everything's okay. And so you have this whole idea that everything may be in the field. All the answers are in the field. And it's the ability to crack the field, to get in the field, to get the material like Tesla and bring it back out of the field into the physical world, that all that material is there. And this phenomena lives in that field. If, for example, if you're in a UFO experiencer and you're on board the ship, and if you have an experience where you knew the answer to everything in the universe, then the beings that are running the ship have got the same information. It's just that when we come back, we lose it. People say, I'm going to remember this. I'm going to remember this. And they say, no, you're not. No, you're not. And the people go back and they forget it all. They just remember. At one point, they knew the answer to everything in the universe. But the beings already know the answer to everything in the universe, because they are the ones that gave access to the people who are having the experience, which would indicate they're not here to study our DNA. They're not here to figure out what we're doing or how love works or envy. They know everything. They're doing something different than trying to be scientists and discover stuff. They're in this field where people are describing, where the answers are all there. All the answers are all in one place. There's no time. There's no space. It's all like a deck of cards, all on top of each other. And if we learn how to do it, if we're open-minded and identify these paranormal phenomena and learn how they work, we can get into the field. We can get these things. We can bring back inventions and innovations, the same as Tyler Gee did, same as Gary Nolan did, and the same as many, many Nobel Prize winners did. That's where they got these inventions.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's
beautiful.
Called,
thanks for your interest.
Yeah, the book's called Weird Paranormal Tales of Apports and Manifestations, and that's on Amazon. I'll put links to it in the show notes. And Can you also tell us about your YouTube channel?
Yeah, I have the YouTube channel. I'm actually doing a very interesting interview tomorrow with Kay Randall May, if you are familiar with the story with her. She was used, I don't think she was too happy about it, so I don't really bring it up, but she was being used by Kit Green when they were looking at injuries of UFO experiencers. And there was a tape leaked out, which I got a hold of and put out on the internet, where Kit Green is talking to her and he's asking her, who are the beings? Where are they from? All this kind of stuff. And she's basically telling him, she's a medical intuitive. And Kit Green on the tape says that he says, I don't know how accurate she is in terms of UFO stuff. I really can't tell that. But I can say that in terms of medical stuff, I'm a physiologist. She's 95 to 100% accurate in everything she says about medicine and people's diagnosis and stuff like that. So what happened was earlier this year, I was diagnosed. I was actually only given a couple of months to live. And so what are you going to do? So then I knew that she had this record. So I went to her and I interviewed, I paid for a reading from her. And she basically said, nope, they're wrong. Nope, I don't care what they say, it's got wrong. And 7 months later, the 5, 6, 7 doctors I had all suddenly agreed that, no, it wasn't what they thought it was, but they didn't even apologize. They just, oh, it's this. And they didn't say, we're sorry, we put you through this, whatever. So I did this reading with her, and then I put it on the internet. And she got a lot of traffic from that. I actually put the exact reading, my whole reading that she did for me 2 weeks after I was diagnosed. She picked this up and she talks about my past lives and all this weird stuff. And I put it all out there. And so she had said, if you want another reading, I said, well, no, I'm not really interested in, you know, what's going to happen in the future. But I said, if you do an interview, so tomorrow I'm doing an interview with Kay Randall May. She has been used by U.S. government. She is one of the most accurate people there is. And I'm going to ask her about how does the world come into, she wrote a book where on quantum physics, on how the world is created. And what they did is, because she's very intuitive, but what they did is she put together a team of scientific people. She's got a PhD, I think, in chemistry. And so they put together a team and they put her into a deep trance. So she's intuitive. And then they put her in this deep trance, got her deeper, 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 deeper. And then they started asking her all the questions about the universe. How does the universe come into, how do atoms come together? How are electrons composed? How does the material world form? And she describes this whole book where she describes how this works. How does telepathy work? All this kind of stuff. So I'm going to interview her about that. I'm going to interview her about intuition. How does intuition work? And I'm going to leave some of the UFO questions out because she's being interviewed by a group that I started many years ago here in Winnipeg, a UFO group. They're going to interview her, and I'm sure they're going to ask all the UFO questions. But I'm going to ask her some of the UFO questions. Who are the UFOs? What are they doing? What's their message? Stuff like that, right at the very end. But I do have one interview. It's probably the most best interview I've ever gotten in my life, except for doing the near-death experience. The guy from Harvard, but fascinating interview. I'm looking forward to it. I've got all my questions ready. And this is probably one of the best intuitives in the world that is going to spend an hour with me and answer the questions that I want to ask. So I do that channel, and I do my paranormal podcast, and that keeps me busy. And I'm doing a book on death. I started a book on death when I was first diagnosed that it was game over. And I'm doing a book on the evil aliens. The whole like concept, are aliens evil? What are they doing? What's actually going on? So that's what I'm working on right now.
Fantastic. Well, you have to come back on the podcast when those books are published.
Yeah, I appreciate your interest. It'll be a while, but I appreciate what you're doing. And thanks for the story about the apport. Now I've got another one I can sort of put out there.
Yeah. Well, anytime you want, tell anybody. It's
Wow. Yeah. Fascinating. It's a lot in Great Britain. Great Britain is sort of a secular society, but when it comes to seances and things like that, I mean, you guys are leading the world. There's nobody comes close to the United Kingdom when it comes to weird seances and ghosts and stuff like that. Beautiful. Thank you, Simon.
And that was an interview with Grant Cameron about his book, Weird, Paranormal Tales of Apports and Manifestations. And if you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode, which is an extra 30 minutes. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. And if you join the $4.50 a month tier, you'll get an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. And there are now over 60 extended episodes available. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 250 episodes. And on the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. And also release an extra episode of the Past Lives Podcast every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And the links are in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. Can I talk to you about a medium? Is his name Kai Mugger?
I watched
videos of him on YouTube after I read about him in your book with these crystals coming out from his eyelids.
That's what they're doing. That's why I think they made him appear out of his ears and out of his nose and out of his mouth. Is the phenomenon is trying to say.